9/11 was so major an event that all of our significant national security policies were re-examined in light of 9/11, including, of course, Iraq. Now, it did that because 9/11 was the first successful example of terrorism of mass destruction.
I'd like to remind everybody that on Friday of this week, Ed McMahon will be here. Not the prize patrol Ed McMahon, but the we have not won millions of dollars. I wish we had. Ed McMahon is a very distinguished Washington trial lawyer who is representing several of the Guantanamo detainees and has argued a couple of the cases all the way up through the appeals system. And he's going to be talking about what it is like to defend some of the most despised people in the world. That'll be 11 o'clock on Friday morning. Last two or three forum, something has come up that I just want to mention very briefly, and that is that during the question and answer session, please try to make questions as brief and succinct as you can. We have 57 minutes on our television production, and if everybody gets up and starts off by saying, geez, we're so glad you're here, it was so great to hear you talk, you know, it makes the speaker feel very nice, but it takes time away from the, you know, the business at hand, the question and answer. And as always, people who watch our program, and as you know, we're now distributing it across the country, people always comment on the civility of our audience. The thoughtfulness of the questions. I always tell the speakers when they come here that we have probably the best informed audience. People read the serious newspapers and they have serious questions. So to the extent we can continue that tradition of civility and respect, while at the same time make questions succinct. We don't need a lot of context. We don't need a lot of background. We don't need to know about your personal history and why you're so interested in this. Just ask the question. And a book signing will follow the forum this afternoon. So at the end, please let our speaker escape to the signing table out front where he will be glad to sign books and engage in conversation one-on-one. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, the chair of the forum. During the past several years, we've had a number of guests who were critical of the war in Iraq, critical of the bases for the war, of what they argued was mischaracterizations and misuse of intelligence, critical of what they call inadequate pre-invasion planning, and of the occupation itself. Some of those guests were indeed people who'd served in high positions, either in the armed services or in the government, or the intelligence services. Others were journalists who've done significant reporting and written books on the issues. None of them, however, enjoyed the intimate vantage point nor the responsibilities for decision making that Douglas J. Feith had from 2001 to 2005. Douglas Feith, who was educated at Harvard and at Georgetown University Law Center, both degrees magna cum laude, served on the Reagan National Security Council as a Middle East specialist and then as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for negotiation policies. After his service in the Reagan administration, Doug Feith practiced law for 15 years and then returned to government service in July 2001 when President George W. Bush appointed him Undersecretary of Defense for policy. He resigned in the summer of 2005, and as one commentator remarked with wry understatement, his tenure in that position was marked by controversy. I must say that I am delighted to welcome Doug Feith because to talk about his book, War and Decision. His book has got two unusual characteristics. The first is financial. A lot of people leave government service, they write a book, they get a big advance, and they use that to cushion their transition period. Doug Feith has donated all of the proceeds from the sale of this book to charities that support veterans and their families, for people who were fighting in the war. Second thing that makes it very interesting is the extensive footnotes and documentation. There are something like 140 pages of footnotes. Now, it's not a quick read. It's not one you go through and just turn the pages. But it is very deeply documented, and that will be very helpful to historians. He's also set up a website so that as you're reading the book, you can go to the endnotes up on your computer screen if you don't want to flip to the back of the book, and you click on them, and you can go to the document or the article, including a lot of stuff that's recently unclassified, but that were documents prepared by the White House or by the Department of Defense or the State Department or wherever. So it's extremely helpful and is a book that I think historians in the future will keep for reference. They may not agree with Mr. Feith's read of the documents, with his interpretation, but they will find his sources and his opinions very useful. Please welcome Douglas Feith. Wave after wave of thunders and clouds.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. It's very nice to be here. I want to thank George Gillam and the Miller Center for creating this chance for me to talk with you about recent history. Right after the 9/11 attack, there was an impressive sense of community across the United States. Fellow feeling among Americans was strong, and across the political spectrum, Americans agreed that we were facing a major and an unprecedented danger together. We thought less about our differences and more about shared national principles, as signified by the enormous number of American flags that went up spontaneously on houses and highways all across the country. But this phenomenal sense of unity and community didn't last very long, and it didn't survive the intense disagreements about the Iraq War. National security debates became bitter and accusatory in the extreme. The quality of public discussion of Iraq, of the war on terrorism, and of other important subjects was often little better than name-calling, with very little respect for facts or for reason. Now, however, President Obama has opened a new era in our politics, and there's widespread excitement about his inauguration and a kind of bipartisan thrill that America has elected its first black president, and it's reinvigorating the sense of community across much of the country, which may make it possible for all of us to benefit from a more civil and more rational public discussion of national security issues, including Iraq. So it should also help, I think, that news from Iraq over the last year and a half or so has improved so amazingly. No serious commentators any longer describe the Iraq War with the kind of unhinged rhetoric that was pretty common some years back, asserting that the war is utterly lost and the worst disaster in U.S. history and the like. So I hope this is a good moment to revisit coolly and calmly a topic that's been the focus of wildly passionate debate in recent years. Why did President Bush decide to remove Saddam Hussein from power? And I'll begin by observing that Iraq was a major problem that the Bush administration inherited from the Clinton administration and from the administration of the senior President Bush. When the Gulf War ended in 1991, the world had two choices, given that nobody believed you could simply ignore the danger of additional aggression from the Saddam Hussein regime. The two choices were overthrow that regime or try to contain the danger. Now, the world was in an interesting situation in 1991. The Soviet Union was on the verge of disintegration. And so the Cold War was basically coming to an end. And for the first time in its history, the UN Security Council was actually in a position to do what it had been created to do. And there was a belief that the UN Security Council could actually, freed from the paralysis that had characterized it throughout the Cold War, with the support of all the great powers, could address a serious problem of international peace and security. And what the UN Security Council did was, in many ways, the great experiment in international relations of the 1990s. It took this problem of recidivist aggression by Saddam Hussein. He had started the Iran-Iraq War, then fought it for 8 years, killed 1 million people. 2 years later, he invades Kuwait, in the meantime having launched a war against his Kurds. At the end of the Gulf War, he launched a war in the south against the Iraqi Shiites. I mean, he was a very dangerous recidivist aggressor. And the UN decided to seize this issue and try to solve the problem as an alternative to armies marching to Baghdad, because the United States was not inclined to do that. Nobody else in the world wanted that done. And so the alternative was this experiment. The UN Security Council would try to contain the danger from Saddam Hussein. And what happened, as we all know, is that this containment strategy had a number of elements, and Saddam spent the 1990s systematically undoing these elements, one at a time. The elements were things like weapons inspections, economic sanctions, the no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq. Now, I'm not going to rehearse the whole history, but let's just remember that it was in 1998 that Saddam announced that he was no longer going to cooperate with the weapons inspections. He has essentially shut down the weapons inspectors and effectively expelled them. When Saddam refused cooperation with the inspectors, President Clinton considered that a very serious challenge to the integrity of the UN and to US national interests. At the time, Representative Nancy Pelosi declared, quote, "Saddam Hussein has been engaged in the development of weapons of mass destruction technology, which is a threat to countries in the region, and he's made a mockery of the weapons inspection process." And Senator Carl Levin declared in October 1998, quote, "It is my sincere hope that Saddam Hussein, when faced with the credible threat of the use of force, will comply with the relevant UN Security Council resolutions, but I believe we must carefully consider other actions, including, if necessary, the use of force to destroy suspect sites if compliance is not achieved." Now, a few weeks after Senator Levin's comment, in December of 1998, President Clinton punished Saddam's defiance of the UN by ordering 3 days of bombing of Iraq, which was called Operation Desert Fox. But the Saddam Hussein problem remained unresolved and worrisome. And when the George W. Bush administration came into office, what to do about Iraq was an important item on the national security agenda. At the time, Iraq was the only place in the world where US military service members were being shot at virtually every day. I'm referring to the US pilots who, together with British pilots, were flying patrols over the no-fly zones over southern and northern Iraq. And at whom, more or less daily, Iraqi forces were firing artillery and missiles. Now, the Bush administration came into office, and there were discussions in the first months of the administration and debates over various proposals short of invasion to deal with the Saddam Hussein problem. There were debates over ways to shore up the economic sanctions, ways to bolster protection for the Iraqi Kurds and for the Shiites, and to diminish Saddam's grip on power, ways to bring about regime change, possibly by a coup engineered by our intelligence community rather than by a military invasion. Now, no decision to fundamentally change US-Iraq policy had been made when 9/11 occurred. There had been these debates throughout the first 6, 7, 8 months of the administration, but it had not resulted in a major new decision on policy. And then 9/11 occurred. Now, 9/11 was so major an event that all of our significant national security policies were re-examined in light of 9/11, including, of course, Iraq. And what 9/11 did is it focused officials on the danger of terrorists using WMD. It focused officials also on the coincidence of the list of state sponsors of terrorism and countries of proliferation concern. Now, it did that because 9/11 was the first successful example of terrorism of mass destruction. For decades, people in the national security community, in the government and outside the government, tended to look at the terrorism problem as a problem of self-limited violence, by and large. I mean, the basic thought was terrorist groups would create small, spectacular, outrageous attacks to draw attention to a political cause in the hope that they can convert that attention ultimately into political sympathy. I mean, the model was the PLO kills, you know, enough Israeli school children in school buses, and then Arafat gets invited to the UN General Assembly as a statesman. So, I mean, that was basically the notion of the terrorism problem. Now, if terrorist organizations' goals were to draw attention to a cause and convert that attention ultimately into sympathy for their cause, then WMD was not a great weapon. And there was not an enormous amount of literature written on the danger of terrorist groups getting WMD. They tended to do spectacular but relatively small-scale attacks, shooting up a ticket counter at an airport or blowing up a bus. 9/11 was different. The people who knocked down the World Trade Center and attacked the Pentagon and had that other airplane heading to who knows where were not engaged in political theater. They were interested in mass destruction. And that focused administration officials on the particular danger that terrorist groups might get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. It also focused us on the enormous operational value to terrorist groups of support from various states, and it also became clear that one of the great dangers, if you look at the risk of terrorist groups getting WMD, is that they could get the WMD from one of their state supporters. So all of that came together and focused attention on the state supporters of terrorism who had records of pursuing, and in the case of Iraq, using WMD. Now, the major strategic decision after 9/11 that President Bush made, and I would argue it was probably the most significant single decision he made in his entire presidency, was that the purpose of US action after 9/11 was not retaliation, but prevention of the next attack. That was an enormously significant strategic decision by the president, and it was unprecedented. No president in the past had ever set that as a goal for the United States following a terrorist attack, that we're not simply going to find the people who did it and punish them or retaliate, but we're going to do everything reasonable worldwide to prevent the next major attack. Now, that required administration officials to consider all key terrorist groups and their state supporters, even groups and countries that were not involved in the 9/11 plot. Again, the issue was not just retaliating, it was preventing the next attack. And there was a need to focus in particular not only on those states that supported terrorists, but also those that pursued, and as I mentioned in the case of Iraq, used WMD in the past. Now, the president had to weigh the risks of, in the case of Iraq, he had to weigh the risks of war against the risks of leaving Saddam Hussein in power. And that was a difficult call. It was clear to President Bush that the Saddam Hussein problem was not going away, but what was going away were the remaining vestiges of the UN Security Council's strategy to contain the Iraqi threat. The economic sanctions were eroding. We anticipated that they would soon collapse and Saddam would emerge emboldened by his victory over the United States and the United Nations. This point, by the way, about the deterioration of the economic sanctions is also made by Hans Blix in his book on the subject. U.S. officials worried that in his effort to dominate the region, Saddam would aim to deter outside efforts to constrain him by developing his conventional and WMD capabilities along with long-range missiles or possibly terrorist alliances to deliver them. A major concern was that in some future clash over Kuwait or some other Iraqi target, Saddam might draw inspiration from the success of the 9/11 attack, providing terrorists with anthrax or smallpox or nerve gas to attack us. Or if he should one day develop a nuclear weapon, he might mobilize yet again, for example, to invade Kuwait, but this time brandish a nuclear weapon. Now, try to imagine what the American people would have thought if these serious concerns had materialized. If the US suffered an attack by a smallpox weapon, and it then transpired that the biological agent had come from Iraq, what would President Bush and his national security team have said to the country? We didn't know Saddam was hostile. We didn't know he was interested in smallpox weapons. We thought he was in a box and contained. We didn't worry about him because he was not responsible for the 9/11 attack. None of those things could have been said truthfully. If Saddam moved again against Kuwait after he had developed a nuclear weapon, for example, critics around the world would have demanded to know how President Bush could have been so irresponsible as to have allowed Saddam to get a nuclear weapon. Under those circumstances, who would have been able to blame the American people for feeling that their leaders had betrayed their obligation to ensure our national security by ignoring Saddam's history? Who could doubt that the same members of Congress who later criticized President Bush for going to war against Saddam would have been condemning him for not having ousted him before the catastrophe? As we heard, many leading anti-war legislators, including Senators Levin, Rockefeller, Representatives Pelosi, Murtha, and others, made hawkish statements about Saddam in the years before the Iraq War. And such critics would have been able to cite their own words to show that they had had the wisdom to call for tough action while President Bush had thoughtlessly allowed the Iraqi dictator to remain in power until the inevitable occurred. And as I said in my book, they would be right. Now, the point I'm making here is not political. My point is that US officials worried about fulfilling their most basic duty to keep the country safe from grave threats at a time after 9/11 when all of us had an intensified concern about our vulnerabilities and a low tolerance for threats to exploit those vulnerabilities. I think that the president made the right judgment in deciding to eliminate the threats posed by the Saddam Hussein regime, though it was always the case that reasonable people could and did differ on that judgment. It was, of course, enormously damaging that the president used intelligence about Iraqi WMD stockpiles that turned out to be wrong. The CIA said that we would find chemical and biological weapons stockpiles, and we did not. But we did find that after Saddam was overthrown, that Iraq preserved dangerous WMD programs, and Saddam had the intention to produce WMD stockpiles after he got out from under the UN economic sanctions, and he had organized the ability to produce those stockpiles in a matter of 3 to 5 weeks as a conscious matter of policy. Now, since my book, War and Decision, was published some months ago, I've heard from many journalists and others that the memoir surprises them in that it tells a story that contradicts key parts of almost all the major books about the Iraq War. For example, it refutes the notion that President Bush came into office hell-bent on war with Iraq no matter what, and that the administration refused to consider the arguments against war. In fact, as the book explains, the most serious analysis of the risks and the downsides of military action in Iraq was produced in the Pentagon by Secretary Rumsfeld and his top advisors, not by Colin Powell or Rich Armitage or George Tenet or other officials who are reputed to have been the voices of caution. Warren's decision contradicts the common allegation that Pentagon civilians didn't plan for post-Saddam Iraq. It explains what's wrong with the charge that the State Department had a plan and that Defense Department officials discarded. It explains what's wrong with the charge that Secretary Rumsfeld and his advisors were dupes of the Iraqi exile Ahmed Chalabi, and what's wrong with the assertion that we intended to anoint Chalabi as the leader of Iraq. My book quotes extensively from previously classified documents, from numerous memos that were exchanged among Rumsfeld and Powell and Rice and Tenet and General Myers and the president. It recounts numerous meetings, and it does so on the basis not of after-the-fact interviews with officials who remember or pretend to remember years after the fact what occurred at these meetings, but on the basis of the notes that I took while sitting in the meetings. And in writing the book, I made the radical decision that I would put in quotation marks words only if they were actually spoken by the characters in my history at the very time and place that I'm describing. I mean, I hope I start a trend. War and Decision explains for the first time the key post-war plan developed by the administration, which is the plan for political transition in post-Saddam Iraq. The plan was developed in the Defense Department, and it aimed to prevent a prolonged U.S. occupation of Iraq. It envisioned putting Iraqis in charge of their own government promptly after Saddam's overthrow. It was built on our experience in Afghanistan. You all remember, when we overthrew the Taliban government in Afghanistan, we did not set up a U.S. occupation government in Kabul. We had the Afghans running their own government right from the beginning. And we actually had developed a plan that was a variation on that for Iraq so that we would not have a prolonged U.S. occupation. But much of the latter part of the book deals with how this plan was undone and the harmful consequences that I believe resulted. Now, I tried to be critical about all the work that I discuss, that of other departments and agencies, that of the Pentagon, that of my own office, and myself. I worked to make the book civil and accurate. And I care about accuracy, which is why I relied so heavily on the contemporaneous written record. As George pointed out, the book is about 530 pages long with about 140 pages of notes and reproduced documents. And I want readers to pay attention to the notes, to read them. I'd be happy if they challenge me on my use or interpretation of the documents. And that's why I created a website. The book is called War and Decision. The website is warandecision.com, where you can go, and as George pointed out, you can call up the endnotes, and any of the documents that are unclassified have links, and you can read the original document and take issue if you don't think that I dealt with it properly or in context. And I really think that that is the essence of scholarship, to put your work out there so that people can challenge it. I'd like to invite you all to read the book and visit the website and plunge into the actual record of the decisions of the Bush administration, which have been so widely misreported both in newspapers and in books. Now, more than 7 years have passed since I was in the administration working on the conceptual foundation for the war on terrorism. I think the strategy remains sensible. The Obama administration undoubtedly will be finding ways to distinguish itself from the Bush administration, but I think that many of the changes in this area are likely to be terminological and symbolic, and much of the substance of the Bush administration approach will continue. Though jihadist extremism remains a serious threat, and one has to assume that there will be terrorist attacks in the future against us, it is a notable accomplishment that the Bush administration's strategy's main goal, preventing another 9/11 scale attack, was fulfilled for over 7 years. I've intended my book to demonstrate how a controversial topic can be debated sharply and vigorously without the kind of personal and reckless attacks that became common during the Bush years. I devote a lot of space in the book to interagency differences and quarrels, and I present the positions that I advocated and the positions that I opposed. And when I set out rival views, I did so with the thought that those who held them should be able to say that their views were presented fairly and in context. Too many former officials write books that declare that their rivals were all foolish or lazy or dishonest, and such books do no good for the country and are worthless as history. I'd like to conclude by quoting a short passage from the conclusion of the book. Are we content that the national security debate in America is as serious and civil as it should be? Is it worthy of the stakes in this war, worthy of the reason we're fighting, to preserve the free and open nature of our society, and worthy of the men and women in our armed forces who are bearing the brunt of this fight? Our military forces are performing skillfully and courageously. Their sacrifices are securing our lives and liberty. We owe them gratitude, and we honor them when we aspire to fulfill our duties as citizens at home as nobly as they fulfill their duties as warriors abroad. Thank you.
I'm going to move to the back of the room, and I invite those of you who have questions, brief, succinct questions, to queue up in the back, and we will take as many as we have time to do. To start off with the first question, Mr. Feith, the phrase war on terrorism has been the subject of a lot of discussion. People have pointed out, well, terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy. How did you all come up with that term?
My understanding is that the president coined it, and he coined it very soon after 9/11. And as I describe it in my book, I think it was actually a rather inspired fudge, as it were, because what the president, I think, wanted to accomplish by using the term war was to make it clear that we were going to deal with this problem differently from the way administrations had dealt with it in the past, which was as a law enforcement matter. He wanted to say a mere law enforcement approach is not adequate after the destruction of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And he wanted all instruments of national power used, including the military instrument. And so we wanted to give the whole effort the label of war as a way of saying this is extremely serious, it's going to involve a lot of resources, it's going to be dangerous, it's going to have a military component. I mean, there were a lot of things he wanted to accomplish with the term war as a way of mobilizing American public opinion and resources for the effort. And especially since he had set this enormously high goal of preventing the next attack. Now, once you say it's a war, there's this question of who's the enemy. And that was an extremely difficult question. I mean, we didn't know right away who had done even 9/11, let alone all the linkages and how you define this network. I mean, to this day, we have difficulty coming up with a neat, discrete definition of the enemy. And the reason is that the enemy network that we're dealing with, I mean, we know there are enemies out there. There are people who are blowing things up and killing large numbers of people in, you know, from, you know, New York and Washington on 9/11 to the you know, the train in Madrid and the subway in London and elsewhere. I mean, we know there's a real problem, we know there's an enemy network, but that network doesn't have a neat definition. A lot of decentralized groups and the like. So what the president did is, by using the term terror, he knew that he was focusing on a means rather than the definition of an enemy, but it allowed the government to have a handle for the whole effort, but still work out the question of who do we want to focus on, and you know, how and what kind of understanding we can develop about the nature of the people posing this challenge.
Shortly before we went to war, Hans Blix, the UN inspector, reported that they had found no weapons of mass destruction, but were seeking more time to investigate. And could you tell us about the administration's reactions to those reports?
The main point that the administration tried to emphasize with respect to these UN weapons inspections was that the Security Council had been absolutely clear over and over again that it did not want to be in a position where the burden of proof was on the inspectors. Because Saddam Hussein controlled his own country. And in a country the size of California, the ability to hide things is very substantial. And everybody knew that if Saddam got into a cat and mouse game with the inspectors, he could defeat the inspectors. It's not hard. He ran the country and he ran a tyranny and it was a big country. And a militarily significant quantity of chemical or biological weapons would fit in a room this size. So, I mean, the idea that you're going to check every space this size in a country the size of California is, you know, just a vain exercise. So the UN said over and over again, Saddam Hussein has the obligation to demonstrate to the weapons inspectors that he has gotten rid of all of the WMD that those weapons inspectors had determined he had had at one point. I mean, we know that he had WMD because we know that he used it. I mean, he used it against the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq War, and he used it against his own Kurds. And so what Hans Blix said himself is Saddam should be able to demonstrate that he destroyed the stuff if he, in fact, destroyed it. Instead, Saddam chose not to cooperate and to kind of play a cat and mouse game. And part of the reason that the Bush administration was not terribly sympathetic to the argument that we should give it more time and more time is when the Resolution 1441 of the UN Security Council was adopted in November of 2002, it said Saddam's final opportunity for some kind of peaceful settlement of this problem is that he will disarm and he will demonstrate that he has done so, and the first step is to make a declaration of what he has. And he then wound up giving a declaration that Hans Blix himself said was dishonest and incomplete in the beginning of December of 2002. And it was in the National Security Council discussion of that dishonest and incomplete declaration where I heard the president, and I tell this story in the book, where I heard the president for the first time in discussing the significance of that false declaration by Saddam, talking with Colin Powell, say, then it appears that war is inevitable. Now, even then, we waited until March, and even then, we gave Saddam one more final opportunity to avoid violent overthrow by offering him the ultimatum of leaving with his family. Nobody believed that he would, you know, accept the ultimatum, but I think the president took very seriously his responsibility to try absolutely everything short of war before he launched the invasion.
Was there ever any pre-war discussion that creating even a successful war would create a strong Shiite state that would be a strong ally of Iran, that would perhaps be even worse for the security of the United States than Saddam Hussein?
Yes, there was discussion of that. And I know that's a point of view, and you know, at some point in the future, people may conclude that's what happened. I don't think it's inevitable, and I don't think it's even particularly likely. The the empowerment, the political empowerment of Shiite Arabs in Iraq, which is now unique because the Arab world does not have Shiite Arabs empowered anywhere with the exception of Lebanon, which is has always been an unusual country. But throughout the Arab world, Shiites do not have political power as a rule, and now they do in Iraq. The idea that the Shiite Arabs in Iraq will necessarily become a cat's paw for the Shiite Persians in Iran is speculative, and they might as easily produce a rival regime that stimulates cravings for democracy among Iranian citizens, and that may turn out to be the result. I mean, we will have to see, but the automatic assumption that allowing the Iraqi people, who are about 60% Shiite Arab, that allowing the Iraqi people to exercise democratic rights is necessarily a benefit for non-democratic Iran is not clear.
In light of the events that have transpired in the last 5 or 6 years, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, do you still adhere to your previously stated idea that the U.S. is to transform the Middle East and generally the broader Islam world?
There's a lot of misunderstanding about that remark, and I know that I get attributed to me the view that I supported the war in Iraq in order to do a political transformation of the Middle East. It's not true, and it was floated around before the war, and I was able to even refute it in an interview with The New Yorker before the war, but it gets repeated anyway. And so I'm delighted to have an opportunity to repudiate it yet again. I do not believe that the president decided to go into Iraq in order to do a political experiment in the Middle East. I do not believe it would have been proper for him to have ordered the military action in order to do a political experiment to transform the Middle East. I think that the president decided to go into Iraq because of the national security threats that the Iraqi regime, given Saddam Hussein's history, posed to the United States and our interests. And now, it was clear that if we went into Iraq to oust the Saddam Hussein regime by force, we were going to have to do something to help the Iraqis lay the foundation for some other government. And it was clear that, being the United States, we were going to try to encourage them to build democratic institutions. And it was also clear that if we succeeded, there might be great benefits in having democratic institutions take hold in Iraq, and that might be inspirational for political reform throughout the Middle East, and that could be a good thing. But that does not mean that we supported the war or that the president supported the war in order to do a political experiment. Think of World War II. The United States transformed Germany and Japan into democracies. But I don't think anybody would say that the Franklin Roosevelt or the United States went into the war in order to do a political experiment to transform Germany and Japan into democracies. And so I think it's an extremely important distinction. I don't think it would be a proper basis for a decision by the president to go to war to simply try to spread democracy by the sword. And one of the things I do in my book is I quote a number of memos that I wrote and that my colleagues at the Pentagon wrote, specifically repudiating the idea that we should be going to war to spread democracy by the sword. Despite that, despite the facts, there are numerous journalists and authors of books and others who continue to assert that was part of an important part of our thinking. But I mean, someday one hopes that the facts will break through the surface.
My question has to do with the U.S. relations with Israel and national security. And to quote Osama bin Laden, we swore that America wouldn't live in security until we live it truly in Palestine. America won't get out of this crisis until it gets out of the Arabian Peninsula, until it stops its support of Israel. That was in October of 2001. So don't you think that if we it will severely curb terrorist recruitment by stripping them of their main recruiting weapon, that being American support of Israel?
Well, I know that there is a school of thought that says that our problem with Al-Qaeda is essentially a policy difference, and it's a policy difference over Israel. I don't think that takes seriously what the Al-Qaeda people actually say. And the Al-Qaeda people have produced voluminous literature, statements, and writings on their worldview and what their objections are to us and why they believe it's important to kill Americans. And it's quite clear, I believe, from what they actually say, that their objections to us are much more fundamental than any policy dispute about whether we happen to have bases in the Middle East or support Israel or any other issue of that kind. I mean, fundamentally, what these jihadists say in their writings is that they aim to, they interpret their own religion as requiring them to fight what they consider to be a gross insult to God, which is people who organize themselves in societies where they arrogate to themselves the right to make laws because God is the only legislator. And they have a very particular objection to societies that are democratic. They view democratic societies as usurping God's unique legislative function for this world. And when they talk about creating their caliphate and the proper state that will live according to God's law, they're talking about doing it and destroying basically the liberal democracies of the world. And it's a much more fundamental objection than a policy dispute. And so I think that, I mean, it's quite clear what bin Laden's political motive is for invoking Palestine and trying to ride a wave of support, but that it's simply not consistent with their literature to suggest that if we changed our policy on Israel, that Al-Qaeda would not object as murderously and as vigorously as it does to us and our way of life and the way we organize ourselves and function. So I think it's important to understand the difference between a kind of tactical political remark that some of these people may make. And also Al-Qaeda for years didn't say much about Palestine at all, and then that statement was kind of a late statement by bin Laden. I think it's important to distinguish between a kind of tactical remark and something that really reflects their deeper thoughts and motives for the kind of very ambitious policies of murder that they've adopted.
After the first Gulf War, the United States withdrew to the borders of Kuwait, and we left the Shia and the Kurds in the north, the Shia in the south, helpless when they had the uprising. And Saddam Hussein brutally came in and wiped out hundreds of thousands of Kurds and Shia. And I was asking why did we in 1991 not decide to nation build, not decide to have a democratic experiment? Like you said, we had a war in 1991, but Secretary Rumsfeld and other Secretary of Defense Cheney and others said that they wanted to get out of Iraq quickly because it would have been a quagmire, it would have been a long drawn out conflict. So why in 2003 then did military leaders, many of whom were the same military leaders in 1991, then decide on the long term presence? Because I think a lot of Americans are okay with the decision of invading Iraq and removing Saddam Hussein, but they're not okay with the decision to stay there for 5 or 6 years and try to rebuild a nation.
Okay, an important correction though. The major campaign against the Kurds occurred at the tail end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1987-88, and it was after the Gulf War that there was the major action against the Shiites. Both involved displacing hundreds, 150,000 or so people and murdering countless people. And nobody knows exactly how many people were murdered in the north and then later in the south by Saddam in those actions. Why didn't we take action after we threw the Iraqi forces out of Kuwait? It was discussed. Basically, the administration of President Bush Sr. said we don't want to march to Baghdad. We assembled our international coalition on the basis of a much more restricted mandate, which was to expel the Iraqis from Kuwait, and they thought it would be difficult and in any event undesirable to try to renegotiate, as it were, the mandate for the coalition to expand the mission to march to Baghdad and overthrow Saddam. And as I pointed out in my remarks, they had at the time an alternative that they thought might work. And that alternative was this great experiment in seeing if the United Nations, with all of the great powers united, which was a unique situation and a reflection of the end of the Cold War, that whether the United Nations could do the job of containing Saddam that would not require us to have to march to Baghdad. And so they had some reasonable basis for thinking, before we launch a major new war into Iraq, we should at least try to resolve the problem through the UN. Now they tried, and they tried for about a dozen years. And what happened was the UN put in place all of these measures, and then, as I explained, Saddam undid them one at a time. I mean, he stopped the weapons inspections, he undermined, weakened, and then corrupted the economic sanctions. And he was shooting at the no-fly zone enforcement to the point where, as you can see in my book, Secretary Rumsfeld in the summer of 01 wrote a memo saying, it doesn't make any sense that we're continuing to do these no-fly zone enforcements. We either have to really toughen them up, in which case we're running the risk of war, or stop doing them. Because if Saddam ever got a lucky shot off and knocked down one of our planes and killed or captured one of our pilots, I mean, what would we say to that pilot's parents that justified the risks we were taking? I mean, the no-fly zone enforcement was kind of a mindless exercise the way it was structured at the time. And the two alternatives to make it not mindless were both bad. One alternative was to stop doing it altogether, which would have been a gigantic victory for Saddam. And the other was to toughen it up a lot and greatly increase the risks of war before the president had decided he was willing to go to war. So we were in a real pickle, and we were in a different situation having tried the diplomatic UN approach for a dozen years and had it fail. We didn't have that alternative. And the president basically came to the conclusion that after a dozen years, the United States and the world had exhausted all reasonable means to deal with this extremely serious threat. And as I said, it was a threat that looked even more serious in light of 9/11. Notwithstanding that Saddam was not involved in the 9/11 attack, everything that was a threat to us looked more serious in light of 9/11. And so, looking at it from that point of view, he decided that the risks of inaction outweighed the risks of action.
Doug, before we go to the next question, I want to call a very brief time out and comment on the extraordinary and I believe unprecedented gender imbalance among the questioners. Now, I know a lot of the women in this room, and they are smart and well-informed and usually not retiring people. And so if any woman will come forward, I will put her to the head of the line. So make sure.
I can talk in a feminine voice if that'll help. The UN sort of showed itself to be a strange organization through this, starting in 91 for the first Gulf War, and then sort of letting sanctions just sort of become unenforceable and ignoring the possible outcome. Do you see a role that the UN is going to take in the future? Is it ever going to be really capable of doing security?
Well, it's an interesting point you make. What Saddam did in defying the UN was extremely damaging to the credibility of the Security Council as an institution designed to play, you know, some kind of constructive role regarding peace and security in the world. I mean, it's interesting to note that Senator Biden, now Vice President Biden, at the time in December 02, January of 03, gave a number of speeches in which he said, we should go to war against Saddam, and we should go to war because there was a ceasefire agreement that was entered into by Saddam and the UN Security Council by means of the set of resolutions that created these different institutions, inspections and sanctions and the like. And he said, the proper justification for the war is that this ceasefire has been broken by Saddam. It's a challenge to the integrity of the United Nations. And if we do not use force to uphold the integrity of these UN Security Council resolutions, we're undermining the effectiveness of the UN, and the United States has a major interest in the effectiveness of the UN, and that's the proper basis for going to war. And he criticized the administration, saying the administration has made that argument, but also made other arguments about preemption, which he thinks are terrible. The proper basis to go to war is to uphold the UN and to deal with the kind of fecklessness that you just described. Now, it is interesting also, I think, that when the US Congress authorized in October of 2002 the administration to use force in Iraq, the resolution of the Congress cited two main legal bases for the military action. One of them was the violation of these UN resolutions, and the other was essentially an American self-defense argument, that Saddam was hostile, had this record, had made threatening remarks, was shooting at our aircraft. It's actually a very long bill of particulars that Congress laid out that was part of a self-defense argument. And so essentially the United States had two major bases in law and morality for its action that were elaborated and enumerated by the Congress. But one of them, for sure, was the importance of upholding the UN General, the UN Security Council's resolutions. Now, I am not, to understate it, an uncritical admirer of the United Nations. I mean, I think the United Nations does some things that are, I think, very counterproductive and I think it's wasteful and corrupt and it screws up a lot of stuff, but it does a lot of stuff well also. And the United States has an interest in the UN performing better. And the United States certainly has an interest in the UN Security Council functioning so that it can get world support for the kind of pressure that would allow us to handle major problems without having to use military power, because if the world only has one option to deal with a major problem and it's military power, it almost for sure is going to fall on the United States to bring that military power to bear. So we have more of an interest in the effectiveness of the UN than most countries have. And President Bush understood this and gave a big speech in September of 02 saying the Iraq problem is not just a challenge to the UN, it's an opportunity for the UN to rise to the occasion. Now, had the UN behaved better, had it passed bolder resolutions, perhaps Saddam might have understood how serious his situation was. What was interesting is that in the interviews that he gave after he got caught, he said that he believed that the French and the Russians were going to save him at the UN, which was part of the reason he didn't take American diplomacy seriously. I mean, our diplomacy was undermined by the fact that the threat of force was less credible than it should have been because the UN was less bold than it should have been. And so there are a lot of ironies here. And, you know, the UN's soft line ultimately resulted in a war that possibly, I'm not saying how likely that is, but it possibly could have been avoided had the UN been willing to take a harder line in defense of its own, of the integrity of its own resolutions.
Saddam Hussein also said that he was absolutely terrified about what the Iranians would do if they discovered that he really didn't have weapons of mass destruction. So if protection of American interests was the main reason to go to war, why was Iraq more of a priority than Iran or North Korea, which at the time had proven or more proven programs that could really affect the United States?
It's a very good question. We understood that if we're going to have a comprehensive strategy to deal with the terrorism problem, we have to deal with all of the major groups that might launch the next major attack against us and all of the major state supporters. So we needed policies for Iran, North Korea, Iraq, Libya, Syria, all across the board. Now, it was not a one-size-fits-all. We needed appropriate policies tailored for each country. I have often been asked that very good question of, you know, why did the administration choose military action against Iraq rather than against Iran and or North Korea? And there's a lot of speculation that people have put forward. They say, well, did the administration think that Iraq was a graver threat, a more important threat? Or did the administration think that Iraq would be easier? I can tell you that from my perspective and what I saw among the other people in the administration, I don't think that the decision was based on either the idea that it was a graver, more urgent, or more or easier problem to deal with. I think the real answer is the president cannot consider military action if he has not exhausted all reasonable means short of war to handle the problem. And with respect to Iran, it was quite clear that we had not exhausted all diplomatic options, International Atomic Energy Agency, UN Security Council options, and the like. Likewise with North Korea, which is the reason that the president launched diplomatic efforts through the Europeans with the Iranians and in the six-party talks with the North Koreans. I mean, there was no way that the president could have used military power back in 2002, 2003 against Iran and North Korea and have said, I tried everything short of war before I went to war. Now, the case of Iraq was different. The case of Iraq, you had an extremely serious problem that we had been addressing over a dozen years since the Gulf War. The UN Security Council had passed 16 resolutions trying to contain the Iraqis, and the president then pushed for yet another resolution, that one that I referred to before, 1441 in November, and then he pushed the threat of military action, and then the ultimatum strategy a few days. I mean, he came to the conclusion that he had, in fact, that the United States over a dozen years had in fact exhausted all reasonable means short of war to deal with the problem. And I think that really, to my mind, is the explanation for why we used military power against Iraq, but not against Iran and North Korea.
Although I agree with you that the extremist ideology does not center around the American-Israeli relationship, and although it may not be a causal factor, to what degree did considerations for Israeli security factor into our rhetoric and our ultimate decision to invade Iraq?
Well, they hardly factored into our rhetoric because everybody was very aware that in any event we're going to get accused of going to war for Israel. I mean, that's what anybody who doesn't like the United States would say. It's kind of an obvious line of attack. And so the administration was quite careful not to give grist to that mill. So it didn't figure in any rhetoric. And as far as the how did it weigh in the actual deliberations in the National Security Council and the principals meetings, I mean, it basically came up, Israel came up on a list. In other words, when we talked about the problems we had with Iraq, those problems were the problems of recidivist aggression, support for terrorists, pursuit and use of WMD, defiance of the UN, and threats to a whole bunch of countries in the region that Saddam had either attacked or threatened in the past. And if you put that list together, you had Iran, you had Kuwait, you had Saudi Arabia, you had Israel. If you remember in the Gulf War, he fired Scud missiles against Saudi Arabia and Israel. So, I mean, Israel was on the list of countries that had been attacked by Iraq. But, I mean, anybody who you know, tries to make the argument that the United States went to war against Saddam Hussein because of Israel has the problem that the record doesn't support that.
The book is War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. The author is Douglas Feith. We thank Doug Feith for being with us today.